Great, thanks, Fred. Okay, hi, everybody. It's fantastic to see how many people have taken interest in this topic and are going to be listening today. It further reinforces how important I feel this is to product development today. We're going to be talking about reliability in the product development process, and specifically all the things that go on with the what end up resulting in the difference between the goals that are established when a product's created, including the reliability goals, and how the end product turns out. And I highly encourage questions at any time. Feel free to jump in on it in the chat window and ask a question, or to go into the Q&A section and ask a question, because I very much want this to be as much as possible a back and forth discussion as we do this, as if we were together. So I'm hoping that not only is this a webinar, but it's the beginning of a collaborative group. There, you're going to see afterwards, I'm going to be talking about how we can continue to communicate on this topic, because I think it's more than just quick discussions on it. I think we need to find ways to not only collaborate, but to share and help each other. The format will be a online forum, which allows us to have continuous communication. And I hope to also have a once a month live meeting. And this will enforce that part of the greater community. So let's get started talking about the topic. So our challenge, we need to not only collaborate with our community, but we need to engage our colleagues in our organizations, our product development teams. So collaboration with them in developing a reliable product is our true end goal. We can't demand or request their assistance. You may have tried that and seen that that doesn't really work. What does work is when people realize that the collaboration will result in the results that they are looking for as well. So we have to get in synchronicity. And we need to create a methodology that does this. And the company makes a very large investment in creating product specifications, but they often lose control of ensuring that the finished product reflects the original product goals. And this can be very evident when performance factors are measured after release and compared to the original goals. And we can understand this and what happens. And if we can, we begin to find ways to develop solutions as reliability professionals, to improve this process. The goals can't be lost as the product development progresses, and that's why we see something that's released that's so different than what we initially defined. So let's talk about the creation of a product. So the goals are created up front. This is going to be captured in a product specification document. It's typically the way it's shared and made sure to be able to be a point of reference during development. So a very diverse community contributes to this product specification document. Marketing contributes. They are looking to see how the company can place itself within the market and what characteristics a product should have that will support this. Leadership's obviously involved because they want to, from a business perspective, ensure that they're getting the right return on investment for the owners and outside investors in the company. Quality, of course, has input because they are looking to ensure that when the product's out there that it's performing well and it doesn't require a tremendous amount of maintenance on a quality side. Sales, of course, they are looking to gain market share, and they have probably contributed to this through defining a niche market where their company and brand wants to be very present. So what are some of the things that have gone into creating this specifically? Well, in this process, some of these things I've mentioned are brought into it. There's also things like new technology. I mean, there's invention happening within companies or within industry, and these can drive a decision to create a next generation product. There's all the inputs and outputs that have to be considered with this specification. It can't just be an isolated set of requirements. You have to be able to have inputs and outputs that match the existing organizational structure and the and outside of the company, especially nowadays where so many functions of the company actually are provided through subcontracting. So we have to ensure all of those things plug in a way where it's realistic to develop this product and have it satisfy these specifications. So where does this go wrong? Our missed connection. And why can't a product development team get together and stay in sync for the entire process? And I think you've experienced this, and that's why you're here and interested in this topic, as I'm very interested in this topic. We experience conflict, loss of focus, and missed objectives that were really reasonable to achieve. And what's happening? Is it lack of time? Is it lack of desire of people who are in the team in the product development process? Do we not care about the success of the product? We really tend to stay focused on our own individual accomplishments. Could we possibly be motivated to even not collaborate? It's a poor structure. And so this is what I hope to uncover in this initiative. And by initiative, I don't mean my own investigations and this presentation. I mean as a community. I'm hoping going forward that we're able to collaborate and to better understand the driving factors, because we want to improve and we want to not just lead the reliability community, we want to lead our own product development teams in doing this better. So let's talk about the product itself. We've created this product. We'll start at the very exciting time of product release. We just finished creating this as product that represents our company, represents our team. It's something that is a cornerstone of our progression and even our personal career. And we believe it's going to hit its target market and satisfy the niche we were aiming for. So, think about some products that you engage with as a customer, and you can pretty clearly see what the product specification structure was like. So take a company like Lexus. They chose to have reliability be the one of the biggest and most significant parts of that brand identity. So much so that when the Lexus brand was initially launched, if any customer had an issue, they actually sent a mechanic to the customer's house. So there's no doubt that that was effectively a goal that was had such a high weighting that it would have been very unlikely that others would have compromised whatever their goal reliability was for that product. So during product development, if time to market was threatening satisfying a technical issue, that I would imagine that the product release date would be pushed out. There's others like, let's say, GoPro, where they're looking to establish a brand based around pushing the ability for the regular consumer to capture video in very diverse environments. So it's really based on features and technological advancements in waterproofing and shockproof and all kinds of other studies of the actual environment and making sure the product performs well and offers customers this ability. So we've released our product, and let's go forward a little bit in time. A few months, say about 3 months after release, a few small issues will come up. That's generally expected. People don't get alarmed. A lot of times we even give them cute names, like these are our gremlins. Teams like QA manufacturing are geared up to handle this phase of product life. They're expecting and have methods for addressing the customer complaints, how to track issues, try to quickly find root cause and come up with fixes that can be very rapidly dispatched out in the field. So, then what may occur is we may have one or two issues that spike. And they spike very fast and very aggressively, affecting a very large percentage of our field and our customers. There's a sense of surprise and alarm. The alarm indicates we're no longer going by the plan. We clearly didn't understand the variabilities that affect our product, and some of these variabilities have now occurred and are resulting in this very high failure rate. The variabilities in manufacturing, variabilities in use, variabilities an environment. So, reason why I'm bringing this up is it's important to have a very specific, I would say, mindset with this, because I feel that a lot of people treat it in a way where ensures it's not going to happen differently next time. It's important to remember these issues were there. They didn't come out of nowhere. And we often just choose to not study them and hope for the best. So effectively, we are, leaving ourselves very exposed. And when you're exposed, you may lose. And this graphic is to represent that the problems will find you. They are out there. And it's not something that's like a car accident, which is the way we tend to address it, that these one or two problems came out of nowhere. We had no way of predicting them or controlling that this was going to occur. But that's not it at all. It's much more akin to if you have gasoline poured on the floor and you really know it's just a matter of time before some static shock or somebody sparks or lights something and it's going to go off. It's not something that could have been, it's not something that could have not been mitigated. So the way that this ultimately gets exposed is we've taken the study of the variabilities, which is what drives reliability, and instead of studying them ourselves, we've effectively let our customers in the field do it for us. And that's quite clearly a very inefficient way to do it. So when you stop and take, and kind of put it in that context, it really seems quite amazing that we do that. And secondly, it seems amazing that we're surprised at the result. So I'd like to share with you a moment here, a story of the contrast of that perspective between the reliability engineer and the other engineers. And this is work that I had done with Boston Dynamics and their robotic mule program. And I can share this because this was covered in an article in Popular Mechanics. And this photo actually captured a great moment that highlights this contrast. If you can see up there in the top right corner, I'm there in the orange sweatshirt with my safety glasses on my head, not over my eyes. And you can see the other engineers are there. And in this photo, you can see that the robotic mule, that there is a tree that's jammed into the shoulder. And it stopped the testing. And on this day of testing, it was the first time we were really doing testing deep out in the woods. And we actually weren't doing the testing. The Marines had come in who were going to potentially be the ultimate customer. And the Marines were driving and using it. So we were learning a lot about how the customer might use it differently than we thought it would be used. We also learned a lot more about the variabilities of environment. So as you can see here, it has framework around it. So it is designed to drive into things and survive. And it also was very intelligent and able to choose to identify things that it can go through and things it can't go through, but it also can be used in a manual mode. And at this moment, it was being used in a manual mode, the first day this Marine was using it. And it hit this tree that was about a 3-inch diameter, and it went right into the shoulder, and it was exactly the right size. If it had been bigger, the mule would have hit it and, changed direction. If it had been smaller, it would have just pushed it down because there's actually protective shields in the shoulder. But 3 inches was exactly the right amount to go in there, jam in the shoulder, and break sensors. So everybody's very upset. And the quote in the article under the picture was, "It sucks that I broke it." That's what the Marine said who was driving it. The engineers were bummed out. I was super excited. The reason why I was excited is because my perspective was this failure mode existed. This failure mode of a tree that's approximately 3 inches in diameter will cause this failure. And whether or not we found it, it existed. And it was going to, if you put enough of these out there with enough people using them, they're going to experience it. So I felt we were very lucky to, in this very limited test, to have observed this failure mode. And now we could easily mitigate this by adjusting the design. Everybody else was very bummed out. So that's the difference in that perspective that I think often leads to the, having effectively these issues due to variabilities be found in the field as opposed to in-house. So these two major issues have been found, and they're dominating our market presence. It goes beyond this. It's threatening the company's brand and beginning to absorb significant internal resource. So What do we do? How does the company generally respond to this? You start to hear conversations of should we stop production of this new product? Can we offer the customers the predecessor product as replacement? And then there's the very common solution of let's put a tiger team together. So the tiger team, if you're familiar with it, it's kind of almost like the idea of a special forces team. It's made up of all disciplines that are believed to be able to solve these one or two very critical field issues. They have a singular goal to solve these issues as rapidly as possible, and it takes priority over their other commitments that they have within the company with this product line or any other product line or initiative that they are working on. So it comes at a very high cost to have this tiger team. So there'll be R&D that's in there. So this means that new product development, new technology they are working on has slowed down or stopped. Leadership's going to be very engaged. They're going to be driving and coordinating this activity and are going to effectively be operating down at a level much lower than they normally would, which consumes a lot of their energy. And this type of thing will be driving meetings, ensuring updates are happening, and having to follow through on things that normally they wouldn't have to manage. So, does anybody want to comment? I'd just be really curious to see if somebody could comment if they've been on a Tiger team. I'd love to see either a comment or a question pop up on that. I see somebody's typing. I see a couple people are typing. Multiple, yeah. So yeah, that's great. So I'm seeing, I don't know if I think you guys can all see the chat window, but multiple and plenty of tiger teams. It's really painful because you know that it's going to cause a lot of collateral damage going forward. It takes a long time to recover even after these issues. After these issues have been solved, because now there's other programs that and progression that was supposed to be being driven that hasn't occurred. So I think probably anybody who's been on one can agree that it's a very inefficient way or phase to have in product development, especially when you see it occurring regularly. So that's interesting here. Joseph just said it even went so far as to be called a Lean Six Sigma project to conduct a study on reliability issues for a system. So it sounds like it became, in their case, it was so chronic that they even tried to give it a special name as if and disguise it as an intentional initiative. Was that kind of the feeling, Joseph, that they were almost trying to disguise it as something they planned to do? Not disguise, okay. They just didn't know how to go about it. Yeah, what do you do? I mean, people start, you're basically throwing the toolbox at it. And everything's reactive. Yeah. So it's interesting. You see that, things that don't really fit as good tools are the tools they have at hand. And then they're trying to adapt them and have them fit in. So again, it becomes even more cumbersome and inefficient. So let's try to understand how we got there. Oh, that's interesting. So all the improvements that were generated from the study are still referred to. Yeah, it becomes cultural. Yeah, that's true. It's really interesting. Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. So it became a part of the culture that this was a regular function, that it was almost expected now, it sounds like, and planned for that when products were released, that this was going to occur and that they had a system for addressing it. So that's a lot like if dealing with house fires by putting more fire extinguishers around rather than trying to understand why things keep catching fire. Not really the best way to go about it. So if we break this down and try to understand why is the fire occurring, what's going on? Let's go back to the beginning of when the project was started. So we'll say about 18 months before release. The product definition is being led by hopefully a balanced set of goals. All these goals pertain to all what I call the product features. What features will it have? What will the time to market be? When will it be released? What will the product cost point be? What will the reliability target be? What will service look like? All of these very specific characteristics that will have goal numbers. So one way I like to plot this out or to show it visually is, in this case, I've taken four product, what I call product factors. So you have a cost goal, you have features you want to have included, a reliability percentage, and a manufacturability. And you can have a target that its placement represents the weighting comparatively between these different items. So if we let's take some product and throw them on here and speculate. So if you have something like the iPhone, you can see that clearly features and reliability have a much higher weighting than cost or manufacturability. So some indications of this, and this is my own assessment by just looking at the product, is that I see that they use screws instead of snap fitting a case. So this obviously is a design for manufacturing no-no to add, steps and extra hardware. But it does create an item that, if you want to have it be able to withstand impacts from being dropped and other situations like that, is going to create a stronger case than snap fit or snap or, parts that lock together and then have one screw that hold it in place. Also, if you'll notice, it has aluminum case instead of plastic. So this can be both attributed to saying it's going to improve reliability, but it's also a feature of the product, right? That's kind of a signature of the iPhone, that it has a nice metal case and not plastic. And aluminum obviously adds a lot of cost compared to a plastic, but they've chosen that features are more important. And it has other features like high-end processors, and the general components are meant to have a very long life and offer, cutting-edge technology to the customer. So you can see how the target for this weighting between these four factors is down in this bottom right-hand corner. So what's another product that would land quite differently on here? One is an entry-level consumer drill. So this would be the kind of drill that a homeowner would purchase at, a hardware store. You can find them a lot of times for under $40. If you take a look at one, the parts snap together typically. There'll be just one or two screws that kind of finally hold everything together, or key locations. I looked at a very inexpensive consumer drill I had and counted the screws, and then looked at the iPhone, and the iPhone has more screws in it than this drill. And when you consider how this drill is intended to be used compared to an iPhone, that's quite a statement. You have plastic instead of metal, very limited features. You have, on a very low-end drill, simply forward or reverse and a trigger to turn it on and off. You have cost over serviceability. It's very difficult to repair. It's not, they've minimized the ability to access things in place of easier manufacturing. So you can see that this is a product that clearly has put cost and design for manufacturing as the highest weighting. And by comparison, if you think about what drove this, it's not laziness or not wanting to have high reliability or features, but they've very accurately assessed their niche market, I believe. If you take this in comparison to a high-end drill, you can buy a drill for $500. That would be targeted, the niche market would be for a contractor. So how do these two customers differ? Well, the home user doesn't have a very high duty cycle. I mean, you're going to use it 2 week, 2 days a month or something like that. And also, what happens if the reliability is poor and it breaks? It's usually not a huge deal. It's a little frustrating, or it could even be a good thing if you're doing a project you don't want to do and you have to stop until you can get to the hardware store again. Not a big issue. You'd much rather have an inexpensive drill. For a contractor, very different. For a contractor, $500 is nothing when you consider, when the drill breaks, that they can't finish the job for the day, and he has employees who can't do their work, and he's paying them by the hour. So reliability is extremely important. His duty cycle is very high. He's going to want features that make his work easier and quicker. Everything it could do, like have a keyless chuck or a clutch in it that's at a specific torque, so that as they're drilling, let's say, sheetrock versus wood, they don't damage the sheetrock, which is expensive. So that would, you can see there that it's both of those drills are, although very different, both perfectly designed because the goals were very clearly assessed and defined. So we create this perfect set of goals for our product. We hand these goals to our team. And this is our vision for how we believe they will use them, that they will act in their role to make sure all these goals are actually going to be achieved. But what do we actually normally have? What we get a lot of times actually is something where each team member has really grabbed just one or maybe two goals, and that is what their actions and role is targeted towards accomplishing. So if you were to ask a project manager in a lot of companies, what is the goal what are the goals for the product? They're going to say time to market. And you'll say, what about the other ones? They'll be like, well, time to market's most important, and that's the one we're not going to compromise. And if you then talk to the R&D engineers, they're going to tell you about a new feature that they're developing that has to be ready on time to be included, because if that feature or new technology is not there, the product won't be competitive. Now, so why are they so singular? Well, if we take a look at their roles, PMs very likely are told that they will receive, a bonus or be considered good at their role if the product releases on time. The R&D engineers know that when promotions are coming around, or they're looking for an opportunity to have more responsibility, if they can say that they were part of developing a new feature or technology that was included in the latest product release, that's obviously extremely advantageous. So if you think about it from that perspective, as myself as a reliability engineer, if you were to put me in a project management role, I believe I would actually probably compromise a lot of the reliability goal to accomplish time to market. And it really wouldn't even be about growth, it would be about survival. Because if I was a project manager who often released late products, I think that I would probably not be selected or for the next project, or could even be let go. So it'd be a matter of survival. So it's not just people, you can't just put it to people caring or not caring. They're almost being forced to look at the project and the goal set this way. So now you have people working together who have selected an individual goal that they feel is most important. And there's only so much resource to go around. So this creates a very competitive environment, because if there is only a certain amount of resource that we're all lobbying for, we effectively are going to be, instead of working as a team, going to be competing for that resource. And now this pulls in other things. This pulls in people tied to their individual career growth, or they are it's going to create rivalry between departments. And so this can be unproductive and also consume a lot of energy. Any of these battles is energy you're using that is not going into your actual work towards the product development. So I feel that this competition drives something that I call the dominant priority method. And I feel it's very important to kind of highlight this, because we experience it, but I'm not sure if we really acknowledge it as it's occurring. Because again, just like the issues find you, we tend to be reactive in here and instead of proactive, which gives us a sense of not having control. So the dominant priority method is, I believe, best characterized by saying that there is a specific priority or goal that is dominant at any one point in time. So what occurs is you have something like time to market. The project manager has successfully driven that as the number one goal. What will happen is then the time to market will have been so dominant for so long that an alarm will sound for another goal. And in this case, cost point became such an issue, because they were driving so aggressively, they weren't giving enough time for more thorough engineering and cost reduction or design for manufacturing, that then became the priority and it switched. And this occurs over and over again. And I feel that this is analogous to if you were driving a car and you had a goal you wanted to get to, and you're using the rumble strips as feedback for when you should put in steering. You've already gone way too far to one side, and you end up with this very dramatic, jerky motion back and forth. And it's very inefficient, It's dangerous, and nobody in the car is enjoying the trip. And so these very gross late corrections is not something that I think you really would attribute to a successful product development program. So the team that's driving this, they're all looking to accomplish our goal. We do have a sense of competition that is occurring. So, as the reliability team now bring a focus to our discipline, where do we feel we are in this group? A lot of times I feel like this guy at the back. And I try to wonder why. Why do I have so much less negotiating ability when resources are being discussed or changes are happening? How come that reliability goal doesn't often end up in the front? And I think probably everybody here could describe that. And I imagine that's what drove people towards this topic. Because anytime I speak about this topic with groups or individuals, there is that very quick, almost camaraderie and therapy session thing of like, yeah, why can't I, convince people or help them see that by not investing this, we're going to have these issues much farther out that are very damaging. And it's not a matter of saying reliability should be at the front all the time or where the resource should go. It's talking about having a better balance. I believe that one of the core reasons for this has to do with the very distant return on investment for reliability compared to some of these other product features I've talked about. So if you talk about time to market is pretty definitive when you're going to find out on your return on investment on trying to release at a certain time, because you will know when the product is released. And you also can tell as you're leading up to it if you're going to hit that or not. So that's very good if you're trying to negotiate and your concern is time to market as the product is being developed. Product features, that's something as well. I mean, you can tell pretty far in advance if you need more time or more money to have a feature be ready to be included. So again, at the negotiating table, you have some pretty good leverage. Same thing for cost target. You can tell how much a product costs almost instantaneously by summing up, the current manufacturing methods for the bill of materials. And you again have something that's very easy to negotiate with. Reliability, when you come to the negotiating table, all you can do is say, I don't, it doesn't seem like it's going to have good reliability. This testing says it's not going to have, and it's not very present. And the unfortunate thing too is it becomes even harder because a lot of time the tests that would be done that would give you the information, the hard information, have been postponed or pushed out or are going to be done at a time where when you get the results, it's too late to use them. So not only is our ROI much later, a lot of times the activities that actually allow you to measure the return on whatever investment there is in reliability has actually been delayed or canceled. So that's a very significant disadvantage. So effectively, there's a trap, and it's set up by well-intended program architects, but it is a trap. So what's the struggle? Well, each discipline has grabbed a goal. There are some that are dominant. At product release, as I mentioned, there's rewards, there's bonuses for having successfully released a product on time. There's justification for promotions with having invented new technology. So there's rewards right there at product release. Then when the issues occurred in the field, there was the Tiger team. And the Tiger team, it was a very emergency type of environment. So there's a sense of being firemen, which is very exciting. And the fire gets put out and the firemen get rewarded. And the rewards can be simply having had a lot of exposure to executives because the executives were down there in the muck with everybody and they got to see that you came in and were a part of the team that solved everything. So, in a strange way, this team was just rewarded twice for creating an unreliable product and then fixing the issues that they created. And it sounds insane when you say it, but I think we've all experienced it. So I'd actually be interested in seeing in the chat window or the QA if this is something that people have experienced. Because it really shocked me the first time that it clearly came into focus what was happening, that effectively the company was unintentionally rewarding this cycle of poor reliability and then putting out fires. You're kind of rewarding the arsonist for setting the fire and then coming and saving the day and putting it out. I'm reading Chris's comment. Reliability engineering tasks and tests would be viewed as something that add cost, delays in the product. Yep. Yeah, usually a very diverse group of people are brought in the Tiger team, which disables a lot of functionality in the company. So let's talk then about this cycle that we then end up in, because this loss goes beyond what I just described with these activities, because now you're starting to set the company into a cycle where that next product that was supposed to include a lot of new technology now will end up being very focused on being a product that just solves these what are effectively become legacy issues. So now you're also hurting your ability to be competitive technically, and this begins to affect your brand, your niche, and what the business was really about. Interesting. Yeah, Chris said, yeah, being on a successful Tiger team is the best way to get recognized. Working on preventing field issues doesn't get much attention. That's my point, is that it's so interesting when you realize that the system has actually been set up to reward this firefighting behavior as opposed to preventative work, which is really what's at the core of what we're trying to accomplish as reliability engineers. So there was an illusion. There was an illusion of collaboration and teamwork. It wasn't real. That team that originally got together and was very enthusiastic became very competitive. So that this whole process ends up, as we're beginning to frame it this way a little bit more honestly, kind of shows that we effectively, the company has created an illusion that it believes is real. And then that's why there's also so much surprise as each time we do this, where just taking a simple step back, you realize, hey, we do this on every product release and every program. So what did the team experience? Well, I mentioned a little bit about that. The team had a great experience, actually. As was just mentioned by Chris, it's the best way to get recognized. It's you probably a really good path for getting a promotion or being seen as a leader or a dedicated employee. You know, here they are, they had a job that they were doing, but they still jumped in the Tiger team and helped. And it's really interesting. And of course, it feeds itself very well. So what did management experience? Well, with management, probably, you know, the lower management, they've experienced something that's probably mixed between what the team members have experienced, where there's a sense of, you know, they may have really helped with the Tiger team and driving all that, but they also will feel some pain if they own an entire product line and they have to deal with all these legacy products that are stopping their product from being competitive. And then there's upper management, which is very close to the business side. And the business side is not very forgiving, because that is where you have the long-term ownership that directly can be directly and very easily measured financially. And this is a metric that's sought after very highly by external and internal financial investing. So upper management really doesn't get the get out of jail free card. And that's where the really big disconnect is, because the irony is they've effectively set up this process that almost ensures that this continues. So for the company now, they've suffered, and what they've set up hasn't served them well. And this can end up in a very severe downward spiral, where instead of inventing new technology, you just keep releasing products that are attempting to address the reliability issues of the previous generation. And, you know, sometimes I've even seen where it's almost strangely disguised, where there is a where they the next product they'll paint it blue and called it the 30 plus, as opposed to the previous generation, which was 30, you know, as if things have been added. But really, all that has been done is you've fixed the issues and released a product as the way it should have been released. But again, that's a tremendous, you know, consuming of team resource and time and market where new features and a loss of competitiveness has been there. And there's a lot of stories of companies that effectively have gone out of business because this cycle has drained them and left them open to market share being lost to competitors. So now that we've really talked about this problem in great detail, let's start to talk about how we may approach this to have it work. What we want to do is have everybody hold the goals together, because remember, the business at the highest level was never disillusioned. They get to see at the end what has occurred, and they don't get to be a team that's moved on and may only be getting rewarded for these short-term accomplishments. So our objective is to have this shared goal methodology carry from the top to the bottom. And so we need to create a system that does that. You can't force that. One method that I believe, and I've been kind of working with, is the idea of what I call bounding. And I'd be really interested in, after this, having people share what they think about this, and hopefully this will become, a topic in a forum, because I think that bounding is, as I've described it and defined here, is not something you could implement, but I think it's the beginning of a seeding ideas and discussions that I think could evolve into something that is could be very helpful with this, with creating a synchronicity. And the idea, quite simply, is to ensure that the goals are continually steering in a way that is done at a very high frequency, low energy, to get to the end goal. And what I mean by that is, again, if you go back to my car driving analogy, if you're using the rumble strips on the side of the road for your steering, your feedback as to if you should be steering, it's a pretty violent ride. If you look at how we actually drive, it almost looks like we're doing nothing. It looks like we're just driving straight towards the goal. And the reason why is because you're doing lots of very small corrections. You're sensing what's going on. You're sensing your trajectory. You're feeling small amounts of forces. You're visualizing and looking at your goal, and you're doing lots of small corrections. And that's the way to efficiently get yourself to a goal. So I think that applies here very, very well. And it's a matter of figuring out, how do you create that closed loop to where you are sensing the right things and making a lot of small corrections. So in looking at other companies, and kind of researching and reading about a lot of companies and organizations throughout the years, there's a few things that kind of stuck out that I thought were worth pursuing, further investigating, and discussing. One of them is the Gore Company, Gore-Tex. Very interesting company. They are definitely known as being one of the great innovators, and they have a very unusual organization. They have no organizational roles. I mean, every person there, if they handed you a business card, it just says team member. And there's no executives, there's no middle management, there's team members. So right there, they've taken away that one of the elements that I believe drove that competition that we were talking about. And I'm not suggesting all companies do this. I just think it's very interesting that they do it, and it fits for their culture and has been successful. But in doing that, they have taken away that part where somebody can grab a specific goal that's most associated to their discipline, that they're going to be rewarded for successfully doing, and creating an internal competition for resource. That's very different than when everybody has the same role and is effectively going to simply be measured on the success of the product, which is success will be then measured on the full profile of goals for the product. For Gore, the CEO is actually voted by the employees. It wasn't somebody who was already an executive. It was an individual team member that is voted to be CEO. So again, very interesting, very different. Here's something else that I thought was quite interesting. They don't allow any team to be larger than 150 members. And this 150 members comes from what's called Dunbar's number. Dunbar's number is something that was first discovered a very long time ago, hundreds of years ago, and was very frequently acknowledged in military operations. It was more formally defined about 40 years ago. But what Dunbar's number is it is an indication of our cognitive capacity to study and to hold in our minds the dynamics of social relationships. What this means is if there's a group that's under 150 members, you can remember your relationship with each of those people and the relationship of each of those people to each other. If you go above that, you lose track. So, and that creates a very different group dynamic. So, Gore has decided to respect Dunbar's number, and they will not make a building that has more than 150 parking spots. If they see double parking happen, they split the group up and create another building. So what they've done here is decided to have a hard rule be the fact that everybody can, in their mind, actively hold an understanding of their relationship with each person and the relationship of each person between each other. And this has further supported that collaborative type of environment. I'm not saying we all need to do this. I just think it's very interesting that they have been able to drive to this. And the result is they have really amazing innovations with their products. You will, if you look at the, you know, we don't, we tend to just think of them as a fabric, you know, Gore-Tex is the main product, but they have lots of other products and they come out with new inventions at really what is an amazing, staggeringly fast rate. They'll be inventing guitar strings, then bicycle spokes, and these things are coming out, you know, with having done their material studies and adapting their current technology to other products very quickly. And I believe you can attribute it to this. And I feel it's worth highlighting because that was one of what I, you know, I pointed out that I believe is one of the cornerstones of the difficulty of when high reliability goals have been set in the product balance not being carried through. I think some of it has to do with team structure. Another element that I think is important is really acknowledging the complex relationship between goals. So, as I described, there was that kind of what I call the rank priority method, where there's a goal that's dominant until an alarm goes off that something else is at risk, and then it switches around. And I don't believe you can do a simple rank order method. It's a much more complex relationship. I think that if we really stopped and tried to define them, we would be creating equations. Equations of ways that the current weighting of resource going to, you know, hitting our cost point, at what point that resource will adjust to features and what percentage of it would. I don't think there's any way to do this as a simple weighting method. This is an analogy that I think helps, I find to be very helpful in communicating this because it, I believe, brings in the focus a system that is appears simple but is as complex and would require complex equations to categorize. And this is something we're all familiar with, balancing a household budget. So if we take four categories that we put our budget into, food, entertainment, clothing, and vacation, and you were to ask me as the household finance person, you got to pull, Adam, you got to pull 10% out of the budget. I might just say, okay, let's just pull it out of food. You know, we'll buy more generic brands, and you know, it's pretty easy to do. No big deal. And then if you said, well, you got to pull 30% out of food, I'm like, ugh, it's going to get a little harder. We're talking about better, you know, meal planning and further limiting what the menu has. I'm like, all right, we can do it, but it's not really that easy. And they've said, all right, you got to pull about 60% out. I'm going to say, I can't. There's no point in having a household budget if you're starving people. So I effectively had really three levels. I had an initial phase where it was not difficult. I had one that was a little more difficult. And then I kind of had a hard limit where I'm like, no, we're not taking any more out of the food budget. Well, this is very different than, let's say, vacation. In vacation, there might be something that's more of like a cancel threshold, where if we were to try to pull 10% out of vacation, all right, no big deal. 20%, meh, it's fine. 40%, you know what? Let's just cancel vacation. It doesn't make sense to fly everybody to a destination and then the next day fly back. Why don't we take that remaining 40% and reallocate it to entertainment? Because that will be much more enjoyed where we have a lot of super fun weekends, or go out to dinner much more or something like that. So it effectively had a cancel threshold when you got to a certain point. Entertainment might be completely linear. It might be, you know, something that every percentage point you reduce it, you're just not doing something as fun. At the top, you're eating out every night and going to great shows. At the bottom, you bought a deck of cards and everybody better learn different card games. You might have something that has a defer option, like clothing might be, to where you actually can get to a point where at any point you can select to defer to stop buying clothes for the year and then to just, you know, buy them again next year. So you'll be out of style and you might have clothes a little more worn out, but that's totally feasible and the household still functions. So I describe that, and I think people can relate to that. But I think if you were to try to write that down and communicate it to somebody else who wasn't familiar with a household budget, you'd actually have quite a hard time writing out, all the equations and the ways that this would work. So if I simply take this and I switch it over to a product development program and product goals, you're going to see, like, so I could take cost point and throw it where food was, reliability where entertainment was. And you kind of see it's kind of similar. There is a point with maybe cost point where if you are going to end up having too expensive a product, there's no point in the program entirely. So you can't go over a certain point. There's no point selling a $60,000 Honda Civic. It's just nobody's going to purchase it. So you're going to have a hard limit. If you have something like features, there might be more of a cancel threshold where if it turns out there's a certain new technology you can't include or develop in this, you really should cancel the program and effectively, wait till you can create a product that can do that. Might be the next product development cycle. Maybe reliability is linear, where you can directly correlate the loss of reliability to sales or niche, but there's no real triggers in there. It just is a ratio between that and with the performance factors that you think would benefit from reliability. So again, it's complex equations. If we try to make it a very simple weighted rank order method, just like the household budget thing, you can see how that doesn't really work. And you end up with just all these very gross corrections from this feedback that's very distant from the time when you really should have been getting feedback and adjusting your steering. So, how do we tie all these together if we are going to create some kind of formally defined relationship? Well, our common objective is ROI. It's relating to the other product and program factors. This is how we make program decisions. And this is what we're trying to achieve as a company with this product development initiative that we're doing. So if you recall, we thought we had this. We actually had this. And what we want is this. This is, I think, if you were to take those three images I just showed, and if I was to ask you which one the Gore company was, it would look most like this, where the goals aren't individually being pulled apart and competing for resource, because there's really no way that's going to end up being the same weighting balance as the original product specification document, like what I showed in that diagram with the four goals and the target. If you set that target at a point for your success, that's what you want the product if you were to plot out the balance of those goals where it should match it. So the only way to get there is if everybody sees that full balance and is driving towards that full balance. There's a method here I've been playing with that I think, again, I'm be very interested. I'm going to be very interested in hearing how the community feels about it, what they think about it. Again, I don't think it's something that will, I don't know if it'd be implemented, exactly as defined here, but I think it probably will be the beginning of a lot of thoughts and discussion that will lead us to something really great. So I call it the focus rotation methodology. And the idea here is that the team, you can't have everybody looking at all the goals all the time. Very ineffective. What you could do is take an individual goal and it's the highlight goal for the week. It doesn't dominate everything you do for the week, but the entire team is aware that that is the focus goal for the week. So at the beginning of specific meetings, those reoccurring standing meetings, steering meetings, design meetings, the goal is mentioned at the beginning of the meeting. This is our focus goal for this week. Let's just kind of keep our ears open for anything in these discussions we're going to be having that relate to it. And then at the end, you would say, okay, did we talk about anything that's associated to our focus goal this week? The focus might be features or design functionality. Are there any actions that we should put in the focus, rotation list? And the team is responsible as a collective group to make sure that anything that was brought up is closed on. So what you've done is instead of giving an individual owner a specific goal that they carry and campaign for, each one is collectively at the same time trying to ensure that these goals stay represented. So we're still allocating resource, but we're doing it non-competitively. We're doing it collaboratively to ensure that all the goals receive the correct amount of resource so that that end target matches the initial product specification target. So to team and goals, if we are using methods similar to this and addressing these fundamental issues we've identified, are going to be naturally synced up. We're not going to be pushing people, punishing people, and competitive. There should be a pretty good natural synchronization that occurs. We need to have transparency to the goals, and the goals need to have cross-functional reinforcement. The cross-functional reinforcement means that there's an accountability that carries over. Each team should create their own metrics associated to those goals. People will respect goals and metrics if they create them, and they also understand best how their disciplines can support them. But they can't do it in isolation. These metrics should be agreed upon and reviewed by the other team members. So we get to create our own metrics and then get to have them shaped and reinforced and agreed upon by our peers. So now ownership has transferred, and I believe that accomplishing this is the thing that we want to accomplish with our community here. This collaboration is something that will start with us, but I believe it should end up being collaboration and these methodologies that will work well with our team, and we'll see that spirit kind of carry over to within our own companies and in our own programs. So for us, I believe the only way we can do this is as a community continue to share. Now, I think reliability is one of those disciplines where there's a lot of isolation as well. We tend to have relatively small departments, and what we lose is the opportunity to have that person over the wall. They're like, hey, have you experienced this? What's going on with this? Can you help me with this? So I believe that if we had a forum, a live forum, where a larger community could effectively operate like that, I think it would help us all a lot. And we'd be not only helping each other, but advancing the discipline, the reliability discipline, because we may end up creating methodologies that proliferate through the reliability discipline in a lot of different industries and help with this. So it's about changing the way reliability is actually incorporated in product development. So I believe that if we keep a forum active where we feel free to communicate about issues, share ideas, and develop methodologies, it'll also become a place where tools that we are developing can be actually effectively beta tested. I've created some tools associated to this that I've even begun to develop software around to help with the visualization and the sharing of information that I would love to have people in this forum actually try and use in their programs and give feedback and participate in continuing to develop them. And I think it's also important that we come together as a large group. Maybe once a month, where we come together with a live meeting where we're able to have discussions and bring that real-time component to it as well. So you will receive an invitation at the end of this for the forum, and I'd be very excited to see people participate in that and begin to discuss our topics and to share ideas on how to improve things. And there might even be some therapy sessions in there. I know we all have our stories that have driven us to want to pull our hair out, because reliability is a discipline that we're obviously you're passionate about if you're involved in it. But it comes with these very unusual frustrations that I think can be overcome. Are there any questions or more comments? I'd love to see more discussion here if there's anything anybody wants to share. I see some questions being typed. We're just waiting for them to pop up. Oh, looks like we lost them. Let's see. Oh, just a thank you for an excellent webinar. The insights. I look forward to participating in the forum. It's great. Yeah, I'm very happy to see that. I'm glad to see the idea of the forum being something that people will find useful. I think of probably many of us with our hobbies or other interests have participated in forums. I know in anything I do, I usually first thing I try and do is find a forum that's involved with it, because it's so great to be able to just simply ask somebody a question and, get a response. And it create in this world of where we're very distant from each other, it really does create a great sense of community and a great sh easy way to share information. All right, well, thank you, everybody. And take care. I look forward to seeing you on the forum.